You've walked into the session called Regeneration, the Basis of Life. My name is Isabel Axio. I'm a senior consultant with RM Consulting Group. I personally work in agricultural and regional areas with state and local, federal governments, as well as agribusiness, and I'm passionate about this topic. I'm also here today as the MC and the moderator for the afternoon session, and I've been a part of the conference and the award steering committee, so it's great to finally be here in person and meet all of the people in real life. Before we get into the panel, I just quickly wanted to set the scene so we're all on the same page. So regeneration for me is a critical principle when we talk about circular economy and really what is different from other concepts around sustainability. It's the system, the process and the thinking that do good, not have minimal impact and not neutral, but something that's truly net positive, that heals and creates a nature positive result. And so with that definition in mind, which I'm sure most of you have heard before, let's shift that idea that regeneration is a tree planting project that offsets a really bad system, but rather a systematic rethink. So for the first hour, we've got four panellists. Each panellist will have approximately 5 minutes to present their incredible experience. So, and then after that, we've got approximately 20 minutes of chat. So without further ado, if I could welcome the panel to the stage. We have Amanda Sturgeon, the CEO of Biomimicry Institute, Jennifer Lauber-Patterson, the Executive Director for Frontier Impact Group, Jennifer, and Poorna Trung, Head of Partnerships at Carbon Neutral, and Justin Pilgrim, Sustainability Manager of Cobram Estate Olives. So, to start with, Amanda, if I could give you the mic and the podium to tell us a bit about who you are and your experience.
Thank you very much. Well, good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to talk a little about my experience in regenerative design. I think regenerative is generally a term used more in the agriculture farming sector, and I think many of you are probably more familiar with the concept in that regard. But over the last 30 years or so, I've been focused on regenerative buildings, cities, as well as building supply chains, looking at how we can make buildings and the places that we spend most of our time in more positive for both communities, ecosystems, and all of our health as well. I've created programs, I've practiced as an architect, educated and advocated for a vision where people and nature work in unison with nature by connecting to nature's principles and systems. And that showed up in various different ways. But a little bit about buildings, if you don't know already. Buildings and the products that they use are responsible for using about 70% of our natural resources globally. So they have a massive biodiversity impact, which is often not seen or understood, especially if you're sitting even in this type of room. It's really hard to know. The supply chains are very opaque. The building industry is extractive, it's wasteful, and it's also responsible for about 40% of global carbon emissions during operation. At the same time, we spend statistically about 90% of our lives inside them. So they are a cultural lever for change. If we change our buildings, it influences all of us, and we all can understand, I think, a new way to think about the future. Essentially, buildings also separate us from natural systems, and they reinforce a human-made versus nature divide, which is at the center, really, of a regenerative future, repairing the divide between humans and nature. We have treated nature in a way that's extractive, it's taking as if it is, an infinite resource when it's actually finite. And well, I think we know that in order to create a truly circular future, we need to change the way that we have our relationship with nature fairly radically. So buildings often separate us from nature by limiting our access to fresh air, daylight, and the products that they consume are often toxic for our health as well as for the whole supply chain of communities that are impacted by them. So what do regenerative buildings do differently to that? They connect their inhabitants to nature and also create positive outcomes for communities and ecosystems along their supply chains. They have the opportunity to be nature positive, carbon positive, as well as circular, and they support their culture and community, and they're very place-based. Now, the challenge with creating regenerative buildings and cities is that you have to think about entire systems. It's very complex, and I'm sure that's something we'll talk more about on the panel. You have to really start looking at sort of the impacts of every single component when there might be hundreds of thousands in a large-scale building. It also requires us to not be siloed, not just focus on carbon, and not just focus on circularity in terms of waste either, but to look at how we're regenerating people as well as those ecosystems along the way. I currently lead an organization, and I think it might be incorrect on the slide because I'm in week two of my new role at the Biomimicry Institute. It's a US-based organization. It's been around for about 20 years, and it's focused on the study of nature to understand what we can learn and how we can mimic nature's principles for how we design and make our world. We focus on innovation, so we have an innovation program looking at how new products can be designed that mimic patterns, processes, natural systems. And we also do a wide range of education and advocacy for nature-based and nature-positive approaches. As well as for buildings, we also look at product design, as well as anything from agricultural solutions to car manufacturing. The ability to look at how nature does things and use it as the basis for how we might design and create our world is infinite, which makes my new role really tough. Where do you start and where do you stop? I think I'm going to close there in terms of my focus on regenerative design and buildings, and look forward to the discussion with the panel.
Great. Thanks, Amanda.
Hello, I'm Jennifer Lauber-Patterson, and I'm from Frontier Impact Group. Today, I'll be speaking about, once I work out how to use this little clicker, IT is not my biggest strength. I'm here to talk about Renewalium. It's actually renewable fuel production using a circular economy model. What I'm excited about with the model that we've developed, I like to think of it more as a land regeneration business with renewable diesel as a byproduct. And I'll explain to you more how I've come up with that. So as a business, we focus around healthy soils, clean energy, fresh air and water. We're a climate solutions business and we've been around for many decades now, the people in our team. So I must admit I love seeing these conferences now because when I was talking of systems thinking and circular economy models, you know, 20 years ago, no one really wanted to talk to me. So it's just wonderful coming here. And what is amazing is just seeing all these people I don't know. And that gives me hope. So congratulations for being here because this is really important for a sustainable planet. So a little bit about Frontier Impact Group, and I am going to connect this in with our circular economy model. But very quickly, we are a holding company that has a number of companies under that. And we do a number of things like fuel production, land regeneration, carbon, fertilisers, a number of things. And what has been frustrating over the many years is particularly when you go out to investment, you're told, just focus on this one thing and we'll give you money. But no one talks about the broader interconnected solution that we need to actually develop these solutions. And I am now seeing a change and a shift, and I think that's really important because in order to get the multipliers in the impact, we need to integrate these solutions in order to get the outcome. So, Renewalium, what is our vision? We've got a $10 billion pipeline, which we're pretty excited about. We want to produce 800 million litres of fuel, 340,000 tonnes of biochar, 180 million litres of wood vinegar, avoid 4.1 million tonnes of CO2 per year in Australia, and create over 5,000 jobs. That's our aim for our renewable diesel business. The first project is planned in Narrogin, and we're progressing along that pathway. We're 70% through the EPA process, so we're getting there. But it's quite exciting, and we've had a lot of support from WA government. It started with $100,000, and now we've got up to $6.7 million, which is amazing. And with the Majura Renewable Energy Park, that's a new one for us. Sustainability Victoria is behind us. What I must comment on, I think for any project that's new, having government behind you, that really makes a difference of where we actually focus on in terms of projects. And we're really grateful for the support from both Victoria and Western Australia so far. So what is the impact on this on regions? What I found was we'd go out there and talk to everyone about, oh, this is so much impact. But it's coming from you as the developer. So it wasn't as trusted, the information, I suppose, that was coming out. So we're very fortunate because Horizon Power from WA, a utility in Western Australia, commissioned a report from ACIL Allen. And in that report, they looked at the pipeline that we were developing just in Western Australia alone. And they identified it would have over a $20 billion GDP impact to the Western Australian economy over the life of the project. So this is the impact that these projects can have, and significant impact on carbon as well. So this is what our circular economy model looks like. We use biomass, sustainable biomass, in order to turn into a renewable diesel. And it's very important that you have the highest integrity and social license in the way that you source your biomass. And that's something that's really critical in the whole model. The renewable diesel production comes in under Renewlium, our renewable diesel brand. And then we produce biochar and wood vinegar that are all good for land regeneration activities. Wood vinegar helps in the nutrient uptake in plants and has many, many other powers in agriculture. And then you've got the biochar that, again, helps in building microbe activity, helps in building soil carbon. So is also, we think, quite critical for land regeneration. So this is where our Frontier Organics and fertiliser business comes in, because we can develop that into further products. We don't do everything ourselves. We like to collaborate. Collaboration is important because you can't do everything yourself. The only things we do ourselves is where we find there's a gap in the market and we have no choice. And that's how our business has evolved. There's also another byproduct that comes out of the biochar. The biochar we produce, it's from a high-temperature pyrolysis system, which is produced at 1,100 degrees. And with the way it interacts with the metals in the process, it actually creates this higher graphene form. Now, graphene usually comes from the mining of graphite, which, as you could imagine, is very carbon intensive. This process is net carbon negative. So that's a real positive, and it also can produce graphene at a much lower cost. Now, graphene is the most conductive, lightest, strongest material in the world. It has so many powers, and I think will be a game changer for the building industry and helping us move to net carbon zero. So what I'm excited about is all these different benefits. We have had to develop a JV around graphene because there just wasn't enough of a focus here. And people said to me earlier today, well, it's been around a long time. Why haven't we seen it more? You know, why haven't we seen these superpowers that graphene can have? It's because initially, when it was developed through graphite, it was over $1 million a tonne. It was cost prohibitive. That's being changed now. And there's a lot of new learnings. You know, we had an experience where someone put 1% of graphene in and it didn't work. And why? because you need to put in 0.3% for it to work. So it's the learning, and this is why we have a JV with a company overseas that's got that learning, and we're bringing them in Australia to actually work with the expertise that we have found in Australia as well. So we've got the fertilisers, the enhancers. So what is the biggest cost in fertiliser, or a big cost in fertiliser? Is transportation. So if we've got some of the precursors, the fertilisers, that are being produced in that local community, we can then create fertilisers or fertiliser enhancers that can go back within that community. We're in the wheat belt, middle of the wheat belt, where there's been a lot of land degradation, and the soil health needs significant improvement. So we can produce it there and be able to produce it at a much lower cost for the local farmers. So therefore, we can improve the soil carbon, we can improve land regeneration. We then got our Frontier Carbon business that can also do carbon projects. But again, with any of our models, we don't do it all. We work with others and we collaborate with others. But this is our systems thinking, and it's so exciting because the benefits to the local community, the increased land productivity, the increased resilience, and even the empowerment of the community themselves. They're really excited by the project and really behind it, and we're really quite excited. And we're only just started in Majura, but the reception from the community has been equally as positive, and I'm really excited to be developing Majura because it is in the local state as well, so we're quite excited about that. So this just is another sort of diagram in terms of the inputs and the outputs that is produced. So what type of biomass? Well, what we use are sources that come from materials that would otherwise go to landfill, they might be burnt, or used for lower value sources. Or alternatively, we could be exporting them. And once upon a time, exporting was better than burning. And so there was nothing wrong with exporting. In fact, some of the leaders were exporting because it was a better thing to do. But now we can develop these opportunities within these communities and the regions can benefit. And we've got energy security because with fuel at the moment, we're importing most of it. We can produce our own fertilisers, and and there's so many other benefits that I've just shared with you. So in closing, I'll talk more if people want to ask some questions on some of those items. But you know what I'm really excited about is these conferences help with systems thinking. And that's where I think we need to go if we're going to get the multipliers and the impact that we need to achieve to get to net carbon zero. But the other aspect that I think is important to be successful is the collaboration. You know, how can we work together? We have to work together better. It was really interesting. I saw a wonderful stand of someone that had recycled plastics, which I think is just extraordinary. And with the graphene that we've got, we can make that fire resistant. So you could imagine the applications if you could be fire resistant. Stronger, we can make it stronger. And we can increase the longevity. So there are a lot of benefits by collaborating, but we shouldn't be the plastic recycler and product developer. That's not our strength. That's not our game. But collaboration is important, and I think that is what's going to ensure that we are successful. So if there's anything that you've liked in this presentation and there's a synergy, would love to chat with you later. Thank you.
Or ask the questions on the actual Q&A. I can see a few coming through, but Fauna, you next.
Oh, cool. Thank you. Hi, everyone. I'm Fauna, Head of Partnerships at Carbon Neutral, and I'd like to send my apologies on behalf of Phil, our CEO, who can't be here today. So if you're not familiar with us, in a nutshell, Carbon Neutral is a carbon offset project developer and our carbon emission consultants. So we're very excited to be here at Circularity because over the years, I've come across countless parties that firmly believe that emission reduction strategies like eliminating waste, reusing and refurbishing, are mutually exclusive to carbon offsetting as climate change mitigation strategies, when in actuality, carbon offset projects do hold an incredibly important place in the circular economy. So carbon offset projects can come in many forms: renewable energy, reforestation projects, biochar. Carbon offset projects are not what most people would usually associate with circular economy. Maybe because carbon is a dirty word, maybe because also offsets with recent controversies related to poor regulation may also be a dirty word. And three, project sounds quite linear, very finite. But if you think about it, isn't renewable energy harnessing the potential from the sun, wind, biowaste and other resources which are readily available without the need to further harvest fossil fuels to generate power? Carbon, something we all contain, because trees, grasses, shrubs, microbes, with the power of the sun, create food from carbon dioxide, which then gets eaten by other organisms like us. I'm seeing a lot of circularities here, so I hope you are too. As the proud developers of Australia's largest biodiverse reforestation carbon sink, I'd like to highlight some examples of various circularities within our Yarra Yarra Biodiversity Corridor, which is a conceptual reforestation corridor that covers over 16,000 hectares of degraded farmland across Western Australia. When people hear of our reforestation carbon project, they often just think, we plant trees, it stores carbon, makes sense. But there's more than meets the eye. For one, the carbon isn't stored in just the plants, but is mass transferred and stored within soils through photosynthesis and organic matter composting. In addition to being carbon stores, the diverse species of plants will serve as food and habitat to native animals, lower the water table to counter salinity, improve water quality, enhancing ecosystem resilience, and of course, cleaner air and a sense of place for locals and visitors. We also don't stop at just planting. We also want to regenerate nature, where we not only aim to bring the land back to as close as how it was before clearing, but to enhance and preserve further environmental and social development in the corridor through strong partnerships with key stakeholders. One of these partners are biological citizen science groups. Their research projects involve searching for and monitoring historically known fauna species that inhabit the land that we plant on. Recently, the scientists were searching for the endangered western spiny-tailed skink in the hopes of setting up a sanctuary to protect them. Although the scientists were unsuccessful in finding the skinks, they unexpectedly captured on camera a Woolly's false antechinus, a small carnivorous marsupial, and according to the preliminary reports, has never been sighted this far south in the Wheatbelt region of Western Australia. As we gain a better understanding of the flora and fauna at our sites, we would adapt our decision-making and operations to protect and preserve them. Another valuable partner are our traditional custodians. We engage with First Nation nurseries to source seeds and seedlings and also employ local Indigenous community members to help control damaging feral pest populations. In a number of our properties in the southwest, we're facilitating the transfer of ownership to First Nations people who have begun work reforesting and managing those sites with support from our operation team when required. In further collaboration, we're also investing in various potential First Nations cultural heritage sites, and if they're found to be so, registering those sites to preserve for current and future generations. Further proof of circularity and the medical benefits that arise from carbon offset projects. If there's one takeaway from my presentation, I'd hope that I've altered the image of circularity as predominantly produced goods that are reprocessed through industrial technologies to also consider the various environmental cycles that are occurring naturally everywhere around us and see that hyperscale nature-based projects are also circular economies that follow the regeneration mantra. Time is not on our side as we're fighting against the climate crisis. We know nature will keep thriving even when we humans are gone. So as the greatest ecosystem engineers this planet has ever seen, let's protect all these circles and diversify our efforts, not only in technology, but also in regenerating nature for a sustainable future. Thank you.
Justin.
Good afternoon. I'll just provide a very short overview for any of you in the room who aren't familiar with Cobram Estate Olives. Founded in 1998, we are now Australia's number one extra virgin olive oil producer. Our most well-known brands are Cobram Estate, but we also have the brand Red Island. In Australia, we have three groves, all in northern Victoria, around 7,000 hectares in total, with around 2.7 million trees. We also have operations in California. We have around 500 hectares and 300,000 trees. As an olive oil producing company, we're vertically integrated. What does that mean? It means that we grow our own trees, we manage our own groves, we harvest our own fruit, we process, we extract the oil, we have our own laboratories where we do the testing, we do the bottling, and we handle the sales and distribution. Olive tree, it has some inherent advantages. It's quite a hardy, drought-resistant, tolerant crop. It's a perennial, evergreen, carbon-fixing tree. So compared to other forms of agriculture, we have some advantages. However, that's not to say there aren't sustainability issues out there. Some examples of sustainability issues that you'll see in traditional olive farming. So you've got a picture on the left here. You'll see the interrows between the tree. There's been a lot of tillage. The ground is quite bare. So you're dealing with issues like soil erosion. The picture on the right, so when you're pruning the trees, traditionally what will happen is that they burn those prunings, and other issues, which I guess are common in agriculture, the excessive use of fertiliser and chemicals. And for olive farming, the waste product once you've actually produced the olive oil. So over 25 years at Cobram Estate, we've strived to improve efficiency and productivity without compromising on the ability for us to provide a high-quality, healthy product and not to compromise the environment. We have a proprietary olive farming system called Olive IQ. And as a result of this system, we produce less than 0.5% of operational waste that goes to landfill. And we do that by looking at alternative value-add products that we're able to create with byproducts from producing olives. We adopt a no-tillage approach, which you can see in our photo of the grove here. We allow the grass to grow in the middle, which is really good for the soil. And what you'll see there as well, compared to the previous slide, but you'll see we actually mulch our pruning. So we're not burning the trees when we're pruning them, we're actually mulching them and returning them to the system. While we're famous for producing high-quality extra virgin olive oil, a key part of our growth strategy is also to commercialise those value-add opportunities with our olive byproducts. So I know there's a bit happening here on this screen. But what we do, not only do we produce olive oil, but with the olive leaves, we actually create olive leaf tea under our Stone & Grove brand. We use olive leaves to create olive leaf extract, which has many medicinal benefits. We have a large range of health and nutrition products under our Wellgrove brand. And any oil that we have that isn't extra virgin, we still use. We can still refine and find alternative uses. So one example is squalene, which is quite popular in the cosmetics industry. However, the traditional source of squalene is from sharks, in shark liver oil. So to be able to provide this as a substitute is really a good thing. One byproduct from producing olive oil is the pit. What we've found are these, it's a really good source of biofuel. It has a high calorific content, so really good for burning. So what we're actually doing is using the olive pits. The picture you see on the left is a burner. We're actually using these pits as a source of heat to generate all our hot water needs on our groves. And any surplus pits that we have, we're actually selling to other companies in the agriculture sector who need biomass. One particular challenge with olive processing is what's called olive pomace waste. And what is olive pomace waste? Essentially, once you've extracted the oil, once you've taken the pit out, you're left with this, the flesh of the olive, and the bottom left-hand corner is typically how it will be stored. It will be put into a containment pond. Some of the issues with this, it doesn't smell great. if left to sit for too long, it generates methane emissions and can be phytotoxic to the environment. So to give a bit of a plug to Sustainability Victoria with the CBIC program, we've received some grant funding for a tumble dryer that we've installed in the top left-hand corner. And what we're using with this tumble dryer is to actually remove all of that moisture content from the olive pomace. And we're using the pits as the fuel to heat those tumble dryers. But what you see on the right is the conversion process. That's the output. So in drying it, we're lowering the amount of waste that we have. We're lowering our methane footprint. And we've found that this actually has a carbon-rich content of about 50%. So to be able to reintroduce that to the soil will be quite beneficial. But we're also looking to share this with the broader olive industry. It's not just for ourselves. It's also to reach out. This picture here is a map of our Boundary Bend Grove in northwest Victoria. It's about 5,000 hectares in size with just over a million olive trees. The areas that you see in purple are areas of remnant native vegetation that exist on our groves that we've mapped and we've protected. We've got about 400 hectares in total. The areas in orange that you see is a recent reforestation project that we've commenced. So we're actually planting native species. We've planted about 166 hectares. And what you see in yellow are future sites that we're planning to reforest of about 123 hectares over the next 12 to 18 months. The area that you see in the green is a nearby reserve that sits next to our grove, and it has an active population of mallee fowl. What I'm trying to, I guess, show with this picture and this map here is, yes, we've got our olive orchards and our rows and we're producing olives, but we've got a lot of potential for reforestation, protection and conservation. I'll just touch on the mallee fowl briefly. You could call it a mascot for our company. It's an iconic threatened species. We have partnered with the Victorian and National Mallee Fowl Recovery Group on trying to protect this animal. There's a live web camera project with the URL up there, which I encourage you to have a look at. But I think what we're most excited about is being able to, if you remember that map, encourage the mallee fowl to come into our groves where we've got that native vegetation to try to expand the population and its distribution. We also have wildlife. I know some people don't like eating olives. Animals seem to be the same. They don't have a taste for them, which is good for us. So it's quite common to see wildlife seeking shelter in our groves. We also have an integrated pest management approach. So we're always looking to reduce the amount of fertiliser and chemicals that we use by using things like this green lacewing, which is a native predator that will target parasite insects on our olive trees. And this is a very small snapshot of our regenerative farming activities, what I've discussed today. The saying goes in sustainability that it's a journey, and that rings very much true for us. We still have a lot of work to do. However, we're most passionate about the ability to deliver a product that's not only good for the planet, but also good for human health too. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you, Justin.
Thanks.
I can see a few questions coming in, but do remember that you can pop your questions in the Q&A if you want to participate in this conversation. Thank you all. Today and this year's theme of the conference is implementing the circular economy. So last year we had a lot of conceptual ideas, frameworks, strategies, policies, and today with this panel I think it's awesome to see built environment, energy, actual regeneration, active farming as an implemented examples of the circular economy principles. To kick off, I thought we could talk about trying to narrow down on the difference between regeneration and sustainability. If we could start by trying to, from your experience, really highlight what's regenerative about the work that you do compared to sustainable. Amanda, do you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think sustainable building or green building has been really, the buzzword in the building industry or the buzz phrase for the last 20, 25 years or so. And from my perspective in the building industry, what sustainability does is sort of keep the status quo. It sustains what we have and makes it a little bit better. So reduces the impact somewhat, reduces the energy we use, reduces the water we might consume, perhaps sources products a little bit better, but essentially it sustains the current status quo. The difference in terms of regeneration is about actually looking about how we can create a positive impact. So versus sustaining and reducing the impact, we're looking at how we completely change the way we design, build, and create cities and buildings and the products that make make buildings to regenerate natural systems and communities. So examples of that, I've worked on projects that have generated more energy than they've used, that clean their water systems and provide cleaner water to regenerate watersheds and entire river systems, that might also create community programs during construction to create jobs and support sustainable forestry systems in that community, that might also look at how they remove all toxic chemicals within a building and start to use nature-based and bio-based materials within their project. So they're switching from using perhaps, you know, a little less energy to looking at generating and regenerating energy for other systems to use. So I also like to think of it from a biomimicry phrase, sort of in terms of it's also about a nutrient flow, thinking about how you're supporting other systems to thrive or survive and providing the nutrients for others versus extracting, which I think sustainability often still supports.
Mm. Well said. And I'm just really interested in how that looks. So how does a building regenerate energy? How does a building feed back nutrients in concrete?
Yeah, there's quite a few examples of buildings that have natural waste treatment systems. I've worked on probably 50, 60 buildings around the world at least that have biological waste treatment systems within them. So they're then actually releasing only clean water to the system.
Yeah.
Buildings are often responsible for polluting and sending out, you know, all kinds of sewage and stormwater to cause environmental impacts downstream. So from a water perspective, buildings are able to sort of treat water on site and release it back into watersheds. Projects also I've worked on where they've had solar renewable energy on the building to be able to generate the energy that they need, and often actually more than they need, and supply it back to the grid or to neighbouring buildings.
Yeah, great. Awesome. Thanks for sharing. And Jennifer, the key project that you're working on is diesel, but as you've mentioned, there's lots of other different things. Could you pick out a little bit what the regenerative principle has driven the sort of design of what you're doing?
Yeah. So in terms of the design, we've looked at creating as much impact as we can on the project and impact for the region that we're working within. So in the case of any of our projects in Australia, it's the byproducts that can help in improving the health of our soils, which I think needs to be a critical priority for Australia. Because food production will continue to be important, but even the unhealthy soils and the impact that has on people health and animal health, which I think is something that isn't talked about enough. The other impacts is the renewable fuel itself. Having a fuel that is reduced significantly, is carbon negative, is a really good outcome, and it burns more cleanly as well. So we're pretty excited by that. The graphene, that improves things because with plastics, they can only be recycled so many times, but with graphene, you can extend the life of that recycling. It improves so many different areas of industry. For example, cement. A lot of people use cement. There are companies in Europe that have reduced the amount of cement they use by up to 50% by using graphene. And less than 1% in graphene. So if cement was a country, I believe it'd be the third biggest country in the world. So we can make significant impacts. And, you know, that bit is pretty exciting. Also, even the waste stream that you use or the resource at the moment, there's a lot of agricultural waste in Western Australia that are being burnt or they're being exported to be, for example, going to Japan, being put in a combustion process. That doesn't sound very sustainable to me. But it was probably better than burning at the time. So it's not a negativity to anyone that's doing that now. It's just about reviewing what is best practice and changing that.
Actually, there's a question from the audience on what biomass is sourced for the production. So maybe with that example, so you said agricultural products there currently are being burnt, which in situ, which is not a great resource use. Yep. Then they were exported, which was probably done in trying to do something better.
Yep.
So how do you select the biomass that you are considering for this project so that you're keeping what needs to be kept but considering what needs can be integrated?
And this is critical for the social license to operate. My biggest fear is seeing people not do it well. And that's happened a lot in bioenergy. And I don't think it's given it a good track record, which is why now it's really important. We really want to build the standards as high as possible and build a benchmark because at the moment they haven't been built yet in Australia. We don't really have standards around it, but they are evolving. There is the EU directive, Renewable Energy Directive, and that's what we follow. So what we're very careful about is not replacing food crops. And in the case of the Narrogin project, it is agricultural waste streams in the wheat belt because at the moment they have such high yields that they find it hard to put it back in the soil, so there's a lot of burning that occurs. So that is some of the source. That is one source that we will be using. The other approach to scale up is to plant trees but on shelter belts. So in Western Australia, there's a lot of oil mallee shelter belts and you can coppice them and use them for energy. But what I love about it, it helps in salinity management. It helps in regenerating the landscape as well as producing fuel. Now, the only reason we hadn't started with that is we need more innovation in the way that we harvest these trees and are able to transport them to make it cost-effective, and that's work that we're also doing in parallel. So that's how we will scale up in that particular example. But what I love with the biomass, it's not just biomass. We can use MSW that uses biomass sources. So we're helping a company in the Dominican Republic at the moment, which is recycling MSW. So they've got a really advanced sorting system that they've partnered with someone that specialises in that from Europe. And in the Dominican Republic at the moment, the landfills are full. So what happens when there's storms? All the waste goes into the ocean, the plastics and everything. So this system will manage that, which will, the impact there is incredible. So we're pretty excited by that project as well.
Yeah, and before this session, we had a bit of a chat in the green room, and one of the things we were talking about was the complexity. And so, sorry, you just mentioned, you know, there's agricultural biomass, there's the potential to grow selective energy crops that also has all this multitude of benefits. And so being adaptive and dealing with that complexity rather than creating one solution and one stream, you're remaining kind of open, which is really interesting.
I think it's important because looking at the highest value for that particular output as well as impact. What's incredible, one tonne of bone dry biomass creates over 300 litres of 100% drop in diesel. So that's not biodiesel that needs to be blended. That means if you have a truck on a farm or a truck on the road, you just need to change your, you know, what you're using. No capital cost.
Number one. Yeah.
And that is a game changer for Australia. So we are super excited by that. And then you've got the value of all the other products we talked about. Having been in the sustainability space, I just get so excited by the model because of the impact.
Yeah, amazing. I'm going to pick up a few questions, but Pauna, just briefly, obviously what you're doing is regenerating, but I know we spoke about before coming on today that previously there was more of an approach that you plant a tree, so you plant a tree, but you're regenerating whole systems. So do you want to talk about how you think the principle of regeneration of nature, net positive, kind of designs the types of systems that you deliver?
Yeah, I guess like I kind of go back to the original idea of when Carbon Neutral started was that we were just wanting to plant trees because we wanted to plant trees. And then as, you know, we got better in our practices because we plant in the wheat belt of degraded farmland where there's very little rainfall, there's issues like dry land salinity, issues with soil erosion. So, you know, when we design a lot of our planting sites, we have a look at what are endemic species, what species can have a good symbiotic relationship with the microbes in the soils. Also, yeah, just seeing what other cultural significance there would be, because we also have a look at the species, whether they can be used for food, for, you know, not just animals, but also for traditional, like, custodians, yep, and local First Nations people. And then also kind of like building it, like how can we maintain this, not just maintain it, but also build it further. So when we plant, we also put in 100-year carbon covenant. We also, yeah, have a look at, you know, all these different stakeholders that can come in and help. Talk to also other other landowners, farmers around the region. Like we were saying before, we do plant in the wheat belt. And like Jennifer said, yeah, there's very high yield areas in the wheat belt, so we try not to be in competition. So it's just kind of like going back to that, yeah, how can we make things better and keep making it better? Mm. And like I said in my presentation, you know, we're also looking at a lot of science behind it, looking at what animals are there, can we protect it, create sanctuaries. And it's not just sanctuaries to protect the animals there. It's also, you know, in worst case scenarios of other catastrophic events happening in other areas, if we can relocate those animals or those species to our sanctuaries, again, having another safe haven there. So like with Jennifer, with everybody, like you just keep digging, keep going down into the rabbit hole, and you keep finding awesome things to do and finding ways to collaborate. And
I kind of feel like the name of your company is slightly misleading, because and someone has asked a question, I'll get you to comment on it too, that it's just a carbon project, but it's not. You're talking about nature, creating reserves, connectivity, land restoration, soil improvement. It's more complex than just planting trees. But someone wanted to understand a little bit more about your comments on how the business responded to the scathing reviews of the voluntary carbon market. So there's obviously more than the carbon market, but what was your kind of response to that, the time of the reviews in that?
Well, it's kind of having a look at not taking everything at face value. So just because there was some speculation on, you know, carbon offset projects aren't real or they're not legitimate, it doesn't blanket cut out all the different projects that's available out there. So it's kind of looking deep into, like, where did the controversies happen? Like, where is it, you know, speculation coming in? Is it, what kind of project is it? What methodology is it? And I know I might be biased, but of course, like, you know, Carbon Neutral, we do Australian Carbon Credit Unit projects. We also have the first and only gold standard project in Australia. So we're quite confident in what we're doing, and we're also open to feedback. You know, if there's anything wrong with these methodologies that we are taking, we would also adapt and change, because nothing is perfect. You don't know what you don't know. So as we get more and more information, we'll be better at, yeah, developing the project, monitoring it, having different information and data sets available to share and be transparent. And I think it's all part of that learning process.
Don't let the imperfect be the enemy of the perfect. Something like that. All right. Thank you. Justin, so such a good case study example of, you know, a couple of farms, and I'd get you to comment on how regeneration has driven your journey, probably, because I think, are you the sustainability manager?
Yes.
Are you going to become the regeneration manager?
Well, I mean, look, I think these labels come up and some stay and some disappear. I think
the one thing that any farmer can latch onto is productivity, efficiency, and that's always been the impetus and the driving force behind a lot of the initiatives. And if that happens to fall into a regenerative label, if it happens to fall into a sustainability label, so be it. I mean, there's definitely a care for just doing the right thing. I mean, our groves are in regional Victoria. Our staff at the groves are from those communities. So there is just an innate desire to do the right thing. I mean, certainly from a regenerative point of view, we look at, rightly or wrongly, we look at what were the farms before we took ownership of them. I'm not going to say what was there, but we can say that, you know, we've improved the soil. We can say that we've improved biodiversity. We're not sure exactly by what indicator. You know, we're really probably more excited about the idea of nature positive rather than net zero, to be frank. And I think that's probably because we've seen that a lot of your everyday Joe Blows a bit switched off when it comes to climate change and net zero and carbon neutral and what does that mean. What we've found with consumer research, mind you, is that people are actually more engaged with the tangibles. So when we say, oh, the olive pits and we use the leaves for teas versus where a net sink of carbon, we know what they prefer. So it's not to say we're not, you know, we're going to do as much as we can to reduce our emissions. But so I think regenerative, definitely at the farm level, you know, it's around keeping the farm in a good state forever. I mean, sustainability is much broader. I think your point, Amanda, is really good, is, you know, sustainability. I think something should have a shelf life with sustainability. I'd love that, you know, in 2100, sustainability net zero is off the agenda, and I'm sure something else will come in.
Can we have it before 2100?
Completely off the agenda, you know, like that would be great. So I think regenerative will always be there for us and a driving force. Sustainability, I think, will be much more fluid depending on, you know, what are those societal, you know, topics and issues of the day. Mm.
Justin, we have a question from the audience that kind of ties into, obviously, you've showcased that Cobram Estate has taken on a journey. Maybe you started with, you know, chipping your mulch in the intro and keeping the grass. And so at what point did you start to value add, go, what can we do to make olive leaf extract? And what were the pushes for that? And what makes Cobram different from other corporate? What has been the driver for your progressiveness?
It's a good question. I think a lot of, I mean, I've been at the company for 18 months now, but a lot of the staff have been there over that journey when it was quite small. Mm-hmm. And I think when you start small, and it's, I mean, at that point, olive farming wasn't at the scale that it is now, and most people would have said, oh, you're not going to make it. Like, that's a European thing. But when you got a workforce that has been there for a while, and innovation is always sort of encouraged, and we'll try it. If it doesn't work, we'll try something else. So I think innovation as part of that DNA has been a big driving force. But also that reality, again, coming back to productivity and efficiency, like all farmers, I mean, input costs are rising. Well, how can you offset that? So how can we find value in waste streams? So I hope that goes a little way to sort of answering that question.
Yeah, definitely. Keep asking questions. We are ticking them off as we're kind of walking through there over here. Amanda, I'll come back to you. There's a question here from the audience in how you see timber and forest fitting into the circular of the built environment and regenerative built environment.
Very good question. Yeah, my last role, Built by Nature, we were focused predominantly in the European market around accelerating the use of mass timber in the construction industry. And there's a couple reasons for that in Europe. Firstly, the sort of sustainability standards within the European forestry industry is pretty secure, would I say. And also, when forests are grown sustainably in a way that is supporting biodiversity, they can also be massive carbon sinks. Of course, there's lots of other opportunities in terms of also protecting soil, and there could potentially be a damaging way to run forestry, but there could also be a really sustainable and productive way. We do know, and I think you mentioned this, you know, the impact of concrete in terms of its carbon emissions globally is about I think just under the carbon impact of United States and China. It's a massive carbon emitter. While there are some really great innovations around substituting the cement in concrete, many of those are going to take a while to scale. And meanwhile, we need other solutions for our construction industry. So, yeah, I think done in the right way, grown in the right way, with the right transparency in the supply chain, timber can lock away those carbon emissions for the life of the building. If it can, if we can convert the amount of forestry that's used for pulp and paper and for biomass and burning, and convert that and put that into buildings where that carbon is stored for 100 years or hopefully longer if the building's built well, we could have a massive carbon impact fairly quickly and in a scalable way. So definitely I think mass timber plays a role. I don't think there's ever any suggestion that it completely replaces concrete and steel, but at the moment globally it's about 2%. I think there's room for it to maybe be closer to 20. And there's quite a few studies, a great one by the Potsdam Institute for Climate Change that look at the world's forests, how we could reforest degraded farmlands without impacting food, and how we could potentially do that in a way that could create a massive amount of carbon reduction in a fairly reasonable time frame. It's definitely a solution.
Yeah,
it's got to be done right.
Do you ever integrate that into your regeneration progress, a selective harvesting in your projects?
Not really. Mm-hmm. No, not particularly. As I said, it's. I mean, we're getting to that point now where we're much more strategic. I mean, we have budgets every year, and you know, we've got to look at high impact things like water usage, for example. So I wouldn't say we've got a regenerative strategy and we've got a budget for that. Maybe we'll get there.
Yep.
So far it's been pretty ad hoc and, as I said, try fast and if it fails, don't do it again. I'm sure that will change, but it's been pretty successful so far.
Okay. And Porna, in your big regeneration projects, do you ever include a selective harvest element?
Not usually because, like I said, we do have a 100-year carbon covenant on it if it is part of our carbon project, but in the beginning there were some other projects that wasn't a carbon project. Mm-hmm. So but in general we don't really want to harvest anything. Wanted to keep storing carbon within the plant and also within the soil.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. We've run out of time. We've definitely picked up most of those questions. But if you have any more questions to our panelists, come and find them in the break. Thank you so much, Amanda, Jennifer, Aporna, and Justin. And now to our next speaker, which is going to be Katie Barfield. So Katie runs Yumi Food, which I'm hoping you've all heard of. I know she started Second Bite too, so she's got a long history of saving food waste here in Australia. For those of you who don't know what Yumi is, it's a custom-built platform that enables large local food manufacturers to manage their end-to-end clearances. And the aim of that is really to reduce food waste. But today she'll talk to us a bit of a different angle. Welcome, Katie.
Groovy, thanks. Thanks for having me. I am going to go a little bit off topic today. So normally I'd stand here and tell you why I think Yumi is the best thing since sliced bread and all of those things. But instead, we thought it would be a little bit more interesting if I told you about all of the pitfalls that I have fallen into whilst creating Yumi, in the hope that maybe you can avoid the hurdles, the speed bumps. I'm sure you won't because they're all there. But the organisers thought it might be interesting to take you through a little bit of a reveal of how I've built my social enterprise, how I've sort of developed in my career and where we've ended up today. So I guess the easiest thing about running a for-purpose business is the fact that we have a very strong why. Why I do what I do is because there's 7.6 million tonnes of food that goes to waste every single year in Australia, and that's not acceptable. And over 40% of that happens at a manufacturing or growing level, so that's the people that make or grow the food, and it never gets to a supermarket or a restaurant or your home. Over 40% of that amount is where it is made or grown. So we want to do something about that. I've been obsessed with this topic for way longer than I ever thought I would be, 17 years. So yes, I was employee number one at Second Bite, started that back in 2006 with Ian Carson and Simone Carson, who were the founders, and we drove that through a seven-year kind of growth. Really, my aha moment happened there as to why I got particularly interested in food waste. Obviously, I'm very passionate about reducing food insecurity, but food waste really piqued my interest when I was standing in the warehouse and I was hosting some farmers that had come over from Africa, female farmers. They do a lot of the farming in Africa. And they were standing in the warehouse and they wept. They literally were crying in our warehouse, looking in our fridges, looking around our warehouse. And Oxfam had brought them out to show them some examples of what we were doing over here in Australia. And I asked them why they were crying. And they were crying because they said they could not ever dream about being able to grow the quality of food that we in Australia saw as subpar and waste. And it just shook me to the core. And I think we've all had those moments. Anyone working in this space or working in the for-purpose space has had a moment where they've said, yeah, that's got to change. That's just not good enough. That was mine. I went on to start Spade and Barrow, and it's culminated in Yumi, which is basically a platform, as was just described, to manage the end-to-end clearance process for those manufacturers which make up part of that 40% of food waste across our system. So we worked there with the manufacturers. Basically, all manufacturers have surplus product. There has been a clearance secondary market for as long as you could ever imagine, as long as they've been around, and it's worth millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars. And it is bought up by traders, and traders buy a lot of this product from the manufacturers. They corner the market, they pay bottom price for it, they hold it, and at times they waste it. It never gets through to donation, and there is absolutely no transparency in that system. What I wanted to do was bring some transparency to what is a very opaque system, and I believe a broken system. And we created custom-built technology that basically manages all of this to enable all of those leakages that happen in the food system to be plugged so that we can move that product through transparently to sale to end users, business users. This is B2B, big scale. So if you've been in a Qantas lounge, you will have eaten Yumi food. We sell it through to the likes of Sodexo, Serco, prisons serve our food, so do some of the hospitals. It is top-notch, top quality. There is nothing wrong with it. Why is it surplus? It can be surplus misforecasting. It can be MLOR, which is the minimum life on receipt that a lot of the retailers require, which is astronomical. They need 75%, some of them, to actually stock the product on the shelf. With your packet of biscuits, you've got 2 years. But if you've got less than 1.5, that ain't making the grade. So there's a whole load of reasons why we end up with product on the platform. We then push it out, and anything that doesn't sell through the platform can automatically, at the touch of a button, be donated. So that's a bit about what we do. But this is, creating something like this sounds so simple. It's the hardest thing I've ever done. I've nearly given up more times than I've probably had hot dinners. And getting the ingredients and the balance of ingredients right is incredibly difficult. This is my list of ingredients that I believe you need if you're going to have something that is going to not only stick, but grow and scale and have massive impact. Obviously, you need some money. You need the right team. You need product market fit, the elusive product market fit that everybody is chasing, and it's incredibly hard to find. And you think you found it many times only to realise that you've got no idea what you're talking about. And then you need to be able to deliver on your mission. This is what it normally looks like. This is what my businesses have looked like. It's just a bloody mess a lot of the time. So building it successfully is really hard. And you fail fast and you realise that you're selling yourself a dream, but actually the best thing you can do is really fail fast and give people your ideas and say, rip that to pieces, make a mess of it, show me where the flaws are, because then I can actually get to something that is valuable a hell of a lot quicker, waste a lot less money, and get some impact faster. So here are the things, my lessons learned. And this is going to be very quick. This is normally a 40-minute presentation, so I'm doing it in 10 minutes. So strap in. always question your assumptions. I didn't. As the CEO of Second Bite, founding CEO of Second Bite, and highly decorated and all of these things, I thought I knew it all about food waste. I thought I knew where I could get it. I thought I knew where it was. I thought I knew how to access it. I thought I knew the right people to give it to me. I did not. I didn't have a clue. Because when people said to me that they were giving me everything they had, I knew that wasn't true, because it couldn't be true, because 40% of 7.6 million is an awful lot, and no one apparently had any other food waste. So I didn't do that. I had assumptions that proved incorrect. So don't assume you know the problem. Do ask the right questions. I was just saying, so, okay, we've built this platform for your food waste. It's fantastic. Give it to us. We will sell it. Everyone wins. That was the wrong question. I assumed there were sophisticated end-to-end inventory processes and clearance processes in the largest FMCG companies in the world. I was wrong. That's only 2% of their turnover. They're focused on 98% of their business, rightfully so, which is selling full price stock into the primary channels and getting maximum bang for their buck because, as we just heard about Cobram Estate, the input costs are going through the roof. So we had to actually start from the beginning, forget everything I knew and say, all right, how does this work? And we were so fortunate that Unilever, Mars Food and General Mills opened the kimono, let us look at the end-to-end clearance process and find the universal pain points that we could then extrapolate, build custom technology to address and solve for those problems. Second learning, do not assume that one size fits all. I thought, great, that's fantastic. We know what we're doing. We'll open up the platform. Everyone can put their surplus product on it. It's going to be great. People are going to come and buy it. Awesome. They didn't. It was terrible. No one really bought it. No one knew why they were coming. And that was because we just spread the whole net so widely. It was like, come one, come all. We had everything from lime powder to ingredients. We had poultry. We had it all going on. It was great, except that it wasn't. And we thought, why is this not working? Like, this is surplus food. It's genuine surplus. We've accredited it as surplus. We've put it through the product evaluation matrix. We've done all the right things. But the reality was we needed to become absolutely laser-focused. So we hyper-focused. We found that we needed to just focus in one really small channel, one small channel that everyone would know why they were coming to the Yumi platform and they would come back for more. They would tell their friends and they would come back. Now, if you told me when I was starting out Yumi that I was going to create this great company that was going to focus on consumer packaged goods, CPG, that had barcodes, that were ready for retail sale, I would have said, not interested. But that has been the foundation of this business that is growing really rapidly. So we had to fix one problem at a time. So we stripped everything back from the platform. These are tough decisions to make when you take white $2 million worth of product off your platform and say to people, you know what, we can take this and we can do something with this because we didn't want to create problems elsewhere. Don't assume that everyone cares as much about what you're doing as you do. We all think it's great. Speaking to the converted, it's like when I do something on ABC, I'm speaking to the converted. You know, I'm really happy that we just filmed Channel 10. That will go live next month. Now that's speaking to the unconverted. Do not assume that people care as much about this stuff as we do, because they don't. We had to completely change the way we spoke about it. I was talking about the environmental benefits. I was talking about the CO2 that wasn't going to be released because of we putting food in landfill. I was talking about embedded water. They didn't care. They wanted to know how much money they were going to make out of the product that sold on the platform. And then all the other things were really great. They were really great too. And it doesn't mean the big companies don't care. It means that if you want to get their attention, you've got to get your messaging right. You've got to package it up right. The more they put on our platform, the more that is sold, the greater the impact that we have. Because it's not going in the ground. It's not going to animal feed. It's going right up that food waste hierarchy where we can give it its greatest value. Don't assume that the first revenue model that you've come up with, even though it might seem to be working, is actually the best one or the right one. It took us a long time to get here. So that I call my trough of sorrow. From CY15 to CY21, oh my God, I'm surprised I've got hair. I'm serious. That was a nightmare. You're like, yeah, I've got it. I don't have it at all. And it wasn't until we completely switched our business model and said, why are people not sticking with us? Like, we're getting this little bit of growth, but it's really not very impressive. Why aren't people sticking with us? And we had to completely rejig our business model, turn it into a subscription model that would be exclusive. So if you want Unilever products now in clearance, you have to come through the Yumi platform. If you want the Mars food products, you have to come through the Yumi platform. That is what we did. We created competitive tension, and then everybody knew where they had to come. You can create that competitive landscape. You drive up the price. You drive up the throughput, and you've got complete visibility of every single SKU. And anything that doesn't sell has the opportunity to be donated. This is revolutionary. It's not happening anywhere else. No one is doing this. We had to literally build this plane while we were flying it and hope we didn't crash. CY24 will shoot the lights out. It'll be double what it is in CY23. Not because I'm a magician, but because we finally found the product market fit. That holy grail thing that I was talking about at the beginning, product market fit. And product market fit isn't that everyone says you're doing a great job and here's an award. It is people want to pay you for the product you have built. They love it. They talk to their friends about it and they give you referrals. That's what's starting to happen. That was the game changer for us. But the number one most important thing, the number one most important thing out of all of this were these guys. And there's a lot more of them, but this is just who was in the office when I took the photo. And the team, my team. I could not have done this alone. It is just an idea until you've got a group of people who actually put their backs, their hearts, their souls into solving the problem with you. And these are all of the qualities that those incredible people have. And so we've been able to go through that trough of sorrow, all those ups and downs, all that pain because of the devotion and the resilience of those people. And that's the list of customers today. There's no minnows on there. They are titans. Getting enterprise customers in and getting them signed exclusively is no mean feat. And as you can hear, it has not been easy. We've returned $19 million to them so far, and we're just getting started. So if I can do it, anyone can do it. There is nothing special about me whatsoever. So hopefully that can encourage a few people out there that may be struggling or maybe in that trough of sorrow to please stick at it, because the more of us that stick at it, that want to see the impact, the more impact we will have and the sooner we'll get to our destination. Thank you.
I don't know if I believe that everyone is like that, but thank you. Super inspiring to have such an experienced and interesting example, but then telling us how to do it. So great, now you can all go and do it. Thank you, Katie. Next, we have Asia Heitavatu from Tetra Pak. I am going to enjoy this. Welcome to the stage.
Great, thank you. What an inspiring speech, Kata. That was wonderful. I hope I can inspire you as well, coming, however, from a multinational perspective into the same topic. So my name is Eija Hietavuo, not exactly as pronounced earlier, but I'm heading corporate affairs for Tetra Pak. And as I know that many of you don't necessarily know Tetra Pak so well, before we get into the regenerative food systems and what we need to do, I'd just like to say a few words about Tetra Pak, because if you know Tetra Pak, you probably know it from a little carton package that you may pour your milk or your alternative oat milk product in the morning, but we're much more. So we were founded by a Swedish innovator, not far from IKEA actually, in southern Sweden about 70 years ago. And while our business is really built upon food and food systems, it started off with a packaging innovation, because our founder, he realized that at the time, 70 years ago, milk was still loose and a lot of milk would be lost in storage because the cold chains didn't exist, etc. And so he innovated on a packaging and processing systems which would allow for longer storage of milk and in a packaged format. So that's what he did. And today the company consists of three businesses. And we are one of the world's largest food processing technology and equipment companies. We're one of the world's largest beverage packaging companies. And we also have a third business, which is about services, where we actually, for instance, bring back equipment and technologies that can be refurbished and resold. And we also offer services in terms of customers wanting to improve water waste or any type of sustainability management, energy transitions, and all that. So that is who we are. And the reason why I'm here talking about food systems and regenerative food systems is that we actually are in the middle of food systems as a company. We operate in 160 countries in the developed world as well as the developing world. And what we see around us is really a food system or food systems which are not functioning. And there's a lot of things that need to change. I'm sure you've seen some of or heard some of these figures. So a third of world's food is actually wasted. So it goes out in lost and wasted in the system. At the same time, food system is the second largest contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. And in fact, next week when the COP28 is starting, there's going to be a special focus on food systems and the climate impact. But food systems is also a big contributor to the loss of biodiversity. It is actually de facto the largest one. And of course, overall in the world, when you look at the waste generated, organic waste as well as different waste, including packaging waste, they really create a challenge. So we as a company really wanted to address and work in this area. So 2.5 years ago, when the UN Food Systems Summit convened the world around the food systems for the first time, we came up with a white paper where we were pondering about the role of industry in different areas, including food loss and waste, which was already recognized as a big topic, but also in other areas. And we got some 200 NGOs and the UN systems, and as well as partners from the value chain, coming back to us saying that, well, Tetra Pak, you are actually in the middle of the food chain, so you don't only have the opportunity to work in this area, but you also should be working it in this area, because you have the possibility to contribute to regenerative and sustainable food systems. So what we've done is we've identified four different pathways which we think that companies like ourselves can contribute to more regenerative and better food systems. And those would be, firstly, it is about responsible and sustainable dairy and what can be done in the dairy transition in this area. So we're happy to have a sister company that actually is also one of the world's largest technology providers for dairy farms. So we collaborate with different types of solutions. We more on the food processing and dairy processing side because there's a lot of opportunities to improve the systems, the current systems, and also to capture a lot of the nutrients that are currently wasted in, as for instance, in raw milk production. One just focuses on getting the milk through and without sort of valorizing the different nutrients that would be able to capture through that process. So that's the first area. The second area where we believe that we can make a difference towards more regenerative food systems is really about new foods. As you know, there's a big discussion about animal proteins today. And while we believe that animal proteins, they play a key role in the future as well, we also recognize the need for protein diversification. And that is why we've created a new business unit that specifically works on kind of new alternative food sources for the future generations. So this includes leveraging sources like algae or fungi or insects, or looking into new food fermentation technologies, which provide a much more regenerative kind of options, together with different kind of plant-based products, where again the kind of the beginning of the chain in terms of the ingredients used. If you really invest in regenerative agriculture, for instance, you can create a totally regenerative solution. So those are the two first ones. Then the third one is the food loss and waste area, where again, much of the current food processing technology solutions and systems out there, they've been designed in a way where you know, there's a certain outcome that is desired in the system without thinking of the side streams or residues or the waste that can be valorized as part of the actual food processing. So we offer technologies and invest in technologies where companies which are currently using, you know, our technologies for different type of categories, they can actually valorize the waste streams, whether it's for human or animal feeds, and actually generate new revenues, but also, you know, reduce the waste, which would create emissions again. So that is definitely an area which we look forward to growing, and I think the policy is going to make a huge difference in this area. We see that EU is now the first one where they are actually going to mandate regulation about losses or the food waste and losses in the production center segment as well. And then the last area really is about improving access to healthy nutrition in a way which where the package actually plays a key role in prolonging and making sure that food is not lost, but it's actually stored and protected for a longer period of time. And our type of packaging actually can store food for almost a year. So those are the four areas. And if we look into some of these examples, so there's actually we will be coming up with four or five white papers in the next week. So maybe instead of I realize that I don't have that much time, so I will be just mentioning some of these things. So we will have a big white paper talking about the role of industry in driving this kind of change and transitions in the food systems, coming up with examples from these four pathways. But it's also a kind of an invitation for us to collaborate and create ecosystems where we can. And I think with our type of company, you know, we also have product development centers where we can bring customers or development agencies, if ever, to develop new products which would be more regenerative food products for the use of different people in around different parts of the world, where you have different ingredients also for your exposure. So I welcome you to study those white papers that are coming out soon. So I can't leave this conference without talking a bit about packaging circularity as well, because it's such an important area, and we heard about the policy frameworks earlier today. So what we've done at Tetra Pak is that we have our design for recycling guidelines, which are kind of the Bible behind our product development. And we, of course, are majority renewable materials. So we heard about the cycle, the ecological cycle of the trees, and how renewable FSC and other sort of certified wood fiber sources provide an excellent source for packaging materials. But we also, beyond the design phase, so we work through our customers and the consumers, we work on the actual consumer education to understand how to dispose of packaging waste when it's being consumed, and what does long shelf life mean in terms of preservation and all that. And at the end, of course, of the packaging cycle, what is important also is the collection and recycling. And globally, we have a team of 70 sustainability experts which specifically work in this area. We have actually one of them here as well today, so just to mention the investments into this area. And knowing that we're running out of time, I just wanted to highlight this, because this is one of the drivers for our work in this regenerative kind of food systems area. It is our carbon footprint, and it kind of brings back the understanding that the more we work on regenerative and circular economy, the better it is for the climate agenda and biodiversity if we do it rightly. And for us, most of our footprint really is about the what we sell, the products, the used technology and equipment, as well as the materials that we need to produce our packaging. So we are dependent on ecosystems where we need to collaborate, both in packaging and services and food processing technology to actually drive results. And I think this as just the last slide to demonstrate that the way we work on sustainability, we have the science-based targets for climate. We're working towards nature positive. We also have for food, we're coming up with targets actually next week, and we call the project Food Positive. But it really is the footprint, you know, looking at the planetary boundaries and how do the food systems actually impact the different areas. What is the role of circular economy in all of this? But also looking at the social impacts, because there is going to be a need for just transition and adaptation through the climate change, which is already impacting many countries and many food systems around the world. So I will finish here. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you so much, Aya. And sorry to boot you off. I think I would like to hear both Katie and Aya speak for 40 minutes to get the full details of these incredible examples of the importance of food in regeneration. So that brings us to an end of this session. It's now time for a break. We have got tea and coffee out in the courtyard over there. And then following the session in here, which is definitely where I will be, is on Indigenous knowledge and perspective of circularity, philosophy, practice and solution. So looking forward to that, and then we have a couple of sessions to follow that in the afternoon. Thank you for coming.